Great. Is this working? Or should I shout? You guys hear me back? Okay, good. I think it's working now. Yeah. Terrific. Well, thank you, Dick, and thank you, Forum Club, for having me here to Naples. I haven't been here. I was in Naples 30 years ago visiting my grandmother. And it's changed quite a bit. It is so exciting to be here. I'll give you a little background. Yes, I was in the venture capital business, and my grandfather was the first venture capitalist in the Silicon Valley. My dad was a big pioneer in venture capital, and he left a great swath, and he went off to work at he was a chairman of the Export-Import Bank of the U.S., and then he went off and was the administrator of UNDP. But he moved to Washington just at a perfect time because I was just graduating from business school, and so I got to know all of his friends, and I learned the business from all of his friends and from him. And got a really good flavor for what venture capital could do for a place. And I became this major believer in that how entrepreneurship and venture capital can really change the world in a big way. I saw it happen in the Silicon Valley with my dad, and then I got a chance to see it for myself firsthand. I took over a little small business investment company and borrowed $6 million from the SBA, and that was the money I started to put to work. And 3 years later, I was on their dirt list because I wasn't able to pay the interest on it. And I said, just hang in there. I had to fly back to Washington. Just hang in there for a little bit. I think we've got some good things in here, and I didn't know if we really did or not. And they did hang in there to their credit. By the way, on the side, at that time, the SBIC program had about 600 SBICs and one person administering the whole thing, okay? Today, there are about 600 SBICs. There are 600 people administering the SBIC program. So, and it's not nearly as successful with all those people, as you can imagine. So anyway, I got off the dirt list and onto the wall of the SBIC program as Venture Capitalist of the Year, because all of a sudden, 1991, all of these companies started to go public, and I went from the dirt list to the wall in about 3 months. So it was kind of an interesting thing. Your fortunes. For you high school kids, your fortunes can come and go through your life. But I backed this one company, and it changed my whole perspective. It was these two young guys, they were 26 years old, and they came to me and they said, hey, we can do this web-based email. And I said, that's very interesting. And they said, yeah, we're going to give it away for free. And I said, I'm a venture capitalist. What are you thinking, giving things away for free? And they said, no, we're going to give it away for free. And I said, okay, you know, they had a lot of chutzpah. And I said, okay, I'll give you some, your first money. And then at the first board meeting, they said, it's up. And I said, what's up? And they said, oh, we have free internet, free web-based email. Anybody can get it. And I looked, and I said, well, that's great. How are you going to get the word out? And they said, oh, we're going to do TV ads and billboards and radio. And I said, we gave you $125,000. You've already burned through half of it. And your $62,000 that's left can buy a nanosecond of airtime or a postage stamp on 101, on Highway 101. And I said, that isn't going to work. And then I thought, wait a second, can't you just get it out to all those people on that internet thing? And they said, oh, no, that would be spamming. So that was a new word I learned. And then I said, well, wait a second, you're giving this away for free. What if you What have you? I was thinking of Tupperware, how the women would create Tupperware parties and the women would then sell to each other. And I said, what if you put a little message at the bottom of everybody's screen that said, P.S., I love you, get your free email at Hotmail. And they were going, oh, God, of the 25 investors that we talked to, why was this the guy that said yes? And then they finally said, no, go ahead. They finally agreed to do it. And they said, but no, P.S., I love you. And to this day, I think we would have had a much more peaceful and loving world if they had stuck with the original program. But in any case, it spread to 18 million, or 11 million users in 18 months. And one email went to one of the guys was Indian, and he sent one email to his friend in India. And within 3 weeks, we had 100,000 registered Hotmail users in India. And there weren't even 100,000 computers in India at that time. So we knew we were onto something. But I had traveled a lot internationally, and I thought, wow, all of a sudden, the borders are dissolving. Our geographic borders are no longer as relevant as they were. And that has driven my entire investment career and my entire life since. What happens if geographic borders fall is that that countries, governments, have to, it turns around. Governments now have to compete for you. Governments are accountable to you. It's not the other way around. And so I started to think, wow, governments are going to have to compete with each other for us, for the citizens of the world, for the entrepreneurs of the world, for the businesses of the world, for the money of the world. They're going to have to compete, and I started to see that. I'd go around and meet with prime minister of this or the department of this in different countries, and each one said, how do we get you here? How do we get the money? How do we get the entrepreneurs? How do we get businesses to our country? And they were starting to think that way. And I was getting a little concerned because the U.S. was kind of resting on its laurels. And then I'm going to sort of move forward a bit here to when I ran into this Korean guy, and he said, yeah, there's this really interesting game that people are playing. And it's half of Korea is on this game. It was a first massively multiplayer game in Korea. And he said, and I'm buying something for my son. I'm buying him a sword for his birthday. And I thought that was a non sequitur. He said, I'm spending $40 on a sword for his birthday. And I said, what do you mean? Oh, okay, that's really nice. And he said, no, it's pixels on a screen. It's a sword that's in the game. And it got me thinking that, oh, boy. People are paying real money for virtual goods. Okay, so that stuck in my head. And then I started to see some of these games where people were, where the game actually had currency in it and governance in it and businesses in it. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. That's starting to be another... And this guy was so into his game that he had a full-time job, but while he worked, he hired another guy to be his avatar so that he could rise up in this virtual world. Okay, so I started to put these two things together and say, okay, there's going to be a physical world, but there's also going to be this virtual world where people live. You see all these kids playing on their games? They're in the virtual world. So then I started to see, I was thinking, okay, the next step is for this game and its money to be connected to this game and its money. And that never happened. I guess the entrepreneurs never really were able to figure out what the exchange rate was. But then I ran into Bitcoin. And it was the first virtual currency that was open, global, and the guy went even farther than that. He decentralized it. He basically said, this is for you. He pretty much gave it to the community of developers that is called the open source developers. He gave it to them. Said, here, you guys build it. Make it distributed. Make it yours. And let's just see what happens. And when they were just getting started, you know, apparently there's this story about a pizza delivery guy who came and he was delivering a pizza to these programmers who were working on Bitcoin, and they said, hey, do you have any money? No, I don't. Do you have any money? No, nobody had any money. And he said, well, we got some Bitcoin. Will you take Bitcoin? And that is considered the most expensive pizza anybody has ever bought. I think that pizza delivery guy is now worth about $20 million. Because what happened? What happened? Okay. This takes you to Metcalfe's law. There's Metcalfe's law, and it says the power of a network is the square of the number of nodes in the network. And here's how it works. If I'm a network of one, it's worthless, zero. But if I bring Dick in, now we have one. We have a network of one because it's one connection. And then if we bring in one of you high schoolers, we bring in one of you, then there are three of us, and now there are three connections. And then if we bring in a fourth person, there are six connections. So if you get six people, or if you get four people now agreeing that Bitcoin is a currency, you suddenly actually do have a marketplace. So that's what started to happen. The marketplace started to explode. Okay, so then what happens whenever these bleeding edge things start to take off is the, shall we say, creative people get involved. And they look at it as sort of, hey, how do I use it for, you know, all the illegal things that I can possibly use it for? And so it was used for illegal gambling and for prostitution and for marijuana and for all sorts of horrible things. And then it was like really beat on by the press and by the government. And it was a horrible, horrible experience. People were thinking, oh my gosh, people are working outside of our economy and they're doing all these horrible things. And so it was a little bit of the Wild West. And then I started to see that people were actually using it for legitimate purposes. People were actually buying houses with it, buying coffee, doing different things. And once they were doing all those things, I thought, wow, this is really an interesting marketplace. And so I invested, but a very relatively small amount at that time for our partners. It was $250,000. And I said, okay, and I'll buy 40,000 Bitcoin for the $250,000. And he said, okay, but we got to go mine it, and then we're going to store it in this place called Mt. Gox. And so I said, okay, great, let's go. And so then all of a sudden, Mt. Gox, the biggest trader, I thought, sure, Mt. Gox was going to be the safe place to go. Either stole it or it disappeared. My Bitcoin just somehow vanished. And I thought, oh, well, you know, that's the end of Bitcoin. It's worthless. Nobody's ever going to use it. And I thought that the next day Bitcoin price will go down to zero and we'll be done with this thing. Well, Bitcoin dropped 10% on the news that the biggest Bitcoin exchange was stole basically all the Bitcoin from that moved across their border. 10%. wait a second. And then I thought, whoa, people really need this. And I started to think about all the uses for it. You can move money across borders. You can bank the unbanked. You can, I think about the unbanked. We have regulated people out of our economy. If you come up to Wells Fargo and you say, here's $35.22 and I want to open a bank account, they'll push you out the door because they know it costs them $200 a year just to regulate that account, just to put up with all the regulations on that account. So anybody who's poor stays poor and is stuck in this new economy that we've kind of created and put barriers around because of regulation. So the unbanked suddenly have a vehicle. They can participate in the world economy. And it got me really jumping. And so I thought, oh, well, God, too bad I lost that. But then another thing happened. The U.S. Marshal's Office, who was railing against Bitcoin for about 2 or 3 years, all of a sudden changed its tune, and you never heard, and all of a sudden the press stopped talking about it, and I didn't quite understand why, because Bitcoin, just so that you understand, is a perfect ledger. It keeps perfect track of everything that happens on this blockchain. And so what the U.S. Marshal's Office discovered is that they could see every transaction. And so they started busting all those criminals. And they busted the guys who did the Silk Road, ran the Silk Road, and there was a big auction. And so I bet on the big auction, and everybody was bidding below market. And I thought, well, you know, I'll bid a little above market. I think this is really interesting. And I got them. And I was the stupid, and then I predicted that Bitcoin, it was at like $600. I predicted that Bitcoin would go to 10,000 by the end of by the beginning of 2018, or before 2018. And as Bitcoin dropped from 600 down to 200, I was clearly the stupidest person in the room. But I had this belief. All these engineers, you know, I like to watch the smart engineers. Where are they headed? And they were all sort of headed to Bitcoin. They were all trying to build an ecosystem around Bitcoin and make it so that it was easy for the rest of us to participate in this new kind of economy. And that was, and so I got it. I wrote it all the way down, and then my son created this whole ecosystem. It's called boost.vc, and he built a whole accelerator around Bitcoin entrepreneurs. And so we were the family of idiots. And it just kept going and going, and we were thinking, well, you know, I still believe this is really important. And then all of a sudden the world woke up and things started to really happen. Well, then there's more. Because I got so excited about it, I started to think about, well, what else could happen with this technology, this blockchain technology? And I discovered that blockchain technology can be tied to everything. It can be tied to your stock ownership. It can be tied to any piece of data. It can be tied to your healthcare data. It can be tied to anything. And it keeps a perfect record that is unhackable on the blockchain. No one has ever hacked the blockchain. People have stolen Bitcoin, but no one has hacked the blockchain. And so this is a permanent record of data. Now think of the value of that to society. And I started to think, the internet really changed a lot of things. The internet changed communications and information and media and gaming and all sorts of things. The internet really changed the world in a lot of ways. There were some pretty big industries that got changed. Well, this has the opportunity Bitcoin and the blockchain have the opportunity to change really big industries. Healthcare, all your healthcare up there on the blockchain. Think of insurance. Insurance can all be done on the blockchain. Banking. Banking is already all being done on the blockchain. Coinbase is making that very easy for you to go buy and hold and whatever your Bitcoin there. And then I thought, well, wait a second. All of these industries that are about to be changed are heavily government regulated. And that may be why they were so slow to change on the with the internet. But then I thought, well, what does government really do? Well, government has a land-based part, and that's what buildings are you allowed to build and how you treat your neighbors and all that. And then they have this virtual piece, which is the biggest part of government. It's insurance, medical insurance. It's your pensions. It's your Social Security, your welfare, your keeping track of you, the census. All those things that government does now have all sorts of friction to them. But if they were all put on the blockchain, they would be done automatically, which is why a lot of people are talking about universal basic income now, because they're saying, hey, look, we can actually redistribute income in a very fair way, get rid of Social Security, get rid of welfare, get rid of any kind of medical insurance, get rid of all of those things, and provide every human with sort of a basic income. And then from there, they go and they build their life. I'm not sure. It's worked in a couple of places and hasn't worked in others, so I don't know whether it's the right thing. But it is a possibility now with the blockchain. So now what does that do? You've got all these governments starting to compete with each other. In fact, I'll give you an example. The Prime Minister of Estonia came to Draper University, which I'll talk about in a sec, and said, just by instituting digital signatures, I saved 2% of my GDP. And then by doing digital voting, all the young people started to vote. Apparently, they didn't like those creepy voting booths. And then we did digital identity, and the crime rate went down, the business climate improved, and we did this virtual residency, and here you are. And he hands me a card, and I'm now the third virtual resident of Estonia. And I said, well, what can I do with this? And he said, oh, well, right now, all you can do is open a bank account in Estonia or buy some real estate anywhere in the EU, which is maybe pretty valuable. But then we got talking, and we started brainstorming, and we thought, wait a second, lots of governance can be done virtually. You guys could have 1 billion virtual residents. And you could be providing them all their medical insurance. You could be providing them all their pensions. And you'd be the most honest government ever, and you would not have the problem of political swings and bureaucracy. And we got very excited about that, and now I've been actually going around and meeting with various presidents and prime ministers in smaller countries, saying, hey, why don't you set up a virtual government and see what happens? And I think that that is going to shrink government in a big way and improve prosperity everywhere. And it's very interesting how governments are responding now. The dictatorships are saying, whoa, this is scary. I don't like this. Let's make it illegal here. The democracies, remarkably, because they're kind of slow to move and a lot of people have to agree, have been receptive. So all the great technologies that are coming out of Bitcoin, blockchain, all of these new, going after these new industries, are going to go to the countries that are the most open, naturally. And so China, boy, China, God, they were wide open for 40 years, and their growth was fantastic, and the entrepreneurs were everywhere, and it was just dynamic. And now they've got a guy who's like command and control, and he shuts down Bitcoin, and he shuts down these ICOs, and so he's losing all of his entrepreneurs. They're all going to other countries, they're all moving, and meanwhile, Japan says, sure, Bitcoin is our second national currency, and we accept ICOs, and so come here. So all these Chinese entrepreneurs, all the brightest and the best Chinese entrepreneurs are moving to Japan and the U.S. And this is getting to be a real sea change. So we're starting to see, and we're starting to see more and more of these blockchain entrepreneurs focused on governance, on global governance, and competing with each other for global governance. I think we're about to, you think that you've seen revolutions in England or having Trump get elected or, you know, Bernie's movement or whatever. You think those were big. Watch what happens when governments get pretty much flattened as this world really starts to open up. But what's really awesome about this is throughout history, the freer the country, the more prosperous the country. And the more regulated the country, the poorer the country. And that has happened throughout history, all the way around. And we are now in the time when those leaders of those countries are making that decision. And as they make those decisions, and this is sort of the central decision, how do you respond to blockchain and Bitcoin? Are you accepting of it? If you are accepting of it, you will get all of the economy coming to your country. And if you are cutting it off, you will go back to the dark ages. This is really, we are going through one of the major sea changes of the world. Okay, now I'm going to cut to Draper University. I started a school. What? Why? Well, I kind of got the feeling that there weren't enough heroes in the world. And I got this feeling when the markets collapsed in 2008 and we watched and everybody buried their head in the sand and we didn't see people rising to the top. Kind of the only guy who rose to the top is Satoshi Nakamura, who has done it anonymously. He's the guy who started Bitcoin. But nobody was rising to the top and saying, this is the direction we're headed, or here's what we should try, or whatever. And I thought, there's something wrong with our schooling. And then I kind of went through it in my head, and I'll give it to you this way. I said, I'm starting a school, to my lawyer, and he said, oh, well, then you're going to have to do this and this and this and this. And I said, oh, God, my eyes were glazing over, and it was looking like, oh, God, why did I even think I could start a school? And then he said something about accreditation, and I remembered that the high school I went to, Andover, was not accredited. And I said, but it's the number one high school in the country. And I said, well, what if we don't want to be accredited? And he goes, oh, then you don't have to do any of this stuff. So I've taken his list as the thing I'm going to do the opposite of in my school. And so there's a grading system, right? And it's like you get an A if you don't make any mistakes. So in my school, we encourage mistakes. We encourage failure. We want people to take stupid risks because it was those stupid risks that created electricity and penicillin and Reese's peanut butter cups and America. This is supposed to be the West Indies here. They were all mistakes. So I think, well, wait a second. How do you get people to start thinking like heroes and be willing to step out even if there's a chance they get an F instead of an A? So we did it, and everything's individualized in the school system, and you're you're reprimanded if you talk in class or if you collaborate on a test or if whatever. And so we do it, we make it team-based. And they're in teams and they're stuck in those teams. And then we bring in speakers rather than having a teacher drone on for an entire year. We have a speaker and we say nobody can talk for more than an hour in at Draper University. Except me, I can do that. And what has happened is we've been able to get the most relevant things into Draper University. And then there, of course, we created things that would never be passable through a board of directors of any school. We have military survival training, and we teach yoga and ballet, and we make them do stupid things in front of the class, and we make them do all sorts of crazy things, and they have to sign their life away before they come. So that I just feel like, okay, you signed your life away. You know, before we take them to survival training, we sort of say, well, you did sign your life away, so, you know, here it is. I won't tell you about survival training, but I'll tell you about urban survival. We have one day where we say, you got 24 hours, get to San Francisco, get a job offer on paper from somebody you've never met before, and then come back. 24 hours. That's the kind of thing we do. We give them challenges, big challenges. They had to, you know, one time we made them sell underwear in Union Square, face-to-face. Kind of fun. But the idea is we're getting them outside of any of the box that they got stuck in high school and college. They strip away their high school hang-ups. They become heroes. And we have been remarkably successful here. We've had about 1,000 students. They've started 350 companies. I'm about to get the hook. I can hear it. The students have come from 72 different countries, and they have started 4 of the best Bitcoin knockoffs already. One of them, this is a 5-year-old school. I don't even think Harvard has the kind of record we do in ICOs. ICOs are the coin offerings, the Bitcoin kind of knockoff offering. We have one that's worth $3 billion today, and one that's worth $500 million today, and then 2 that are over $10 million. And these are students that we had. We taught them about Bitcoin 10 years before Stanford will have a course on Bitcoin. They knew about it. And so they have an opportunity because we get the speakers who are the most relevant for the time. And it makes a big difference. The students learn what's relevant, what's really important before they go out. And we only take them for either 7 weeks in the summer or 4 months in the fall. We don't take them for 4 years. So this is world-changing. It's funny, I had the guy from Harvard Business School was raising money, came and visited with me, and I showed him the school, and he said, "You're our competition." He was terrified. Anyway, I think my time is up, except we're going to go on to a Q&A. Thank you for listening. It's been really fun.
All right. Tim, thank you.
My pleasure.
You to know what good students we are. I'm going to start with 2 fundamental questions, and we want a one-sentence answer.
All right. Oh, are they all? They're all about the Naked Brothers band, right?
No, that's coming. What is a Bitcoin?
Okay.
I got about 10 of those.
Okay, a Bitcoin is a contract between two people that is set in stone. Think of it as a contract between two people set in stone. It is, okay, I'll get into what cash is. We used to, you know, go and we'd pay for, you know, beef with shells, right? And then the shells got too heavy for the guys who got rich. And so they were sort of saying, hey, these shells, they aren't really working. So let's think of you know, other shiny objects, and they went to gold. And then people were carrying around gold, and then that got to be kind of a pain because it was like, okay, how much gold and the weighing and all that stuff. And they say, okay, well, let's just, I'll promise you the gold. And then there was, a piece of paper said promise of gold. And then it was silver certificates because they ran out of gold. And they said, okay, well, we can at least back it up with silver. And then in the U.S., they sort of said, well, this isn't any good. We have to just sort of kind of spread more dollars because that is going to increase our economy. And so let's just say it's the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And then that started to be the thing. It was a promise. Each one was a promise. And our bank was sort of that trusted third party that would hold, if I were buying an elephant and selling a cup of coffee, I need some change. I need something. And so that's what the bank was for. It was like to keep that change. Well, now the blockchain is your bank. It's your trusted third party. You don't need the people and the brick building and the whole thing. This is your bank, and it is much more secure. My Bitcoin is way, way more secure than my dollars at Morgan Stanley. Certainly right. More secure than my dollars at...
Now, you think that was the tough question.
Okay, but anyway, that's what Bitcoin is. It's programming in the sky up there. It's software written so that people can have a trusted third party that's unhackable, and they use that for exchange, and it has been amazing. People are selling houses, cars, planes, coffee, funds, whatever.
Okay, that was the simple question. The second question, that's the most common one I got, is what is the blockchain?
Okay, so the blockchain is, think of it as a perfect ledger, a ledger that, think of the perfect accountant who keeps debits over here and credits over here. The blockchain keeps perfect debits and credits. They know who owns what. And it's set up in blocks of sometimes it's blocks of Bitcoin, sometimes it's blocks of data, of information. And it moves, and each block is then verified by, I may be going too deep here, but it's verified by miners. It's like they're mining for gold. There are a bunch of people who are playing a game to try to get Bitcoin that's out there in the cybersphere. They're out mining for Bitcoin, and while they mine for Bitcoin, the only way they can receive a Bitcoin is by verifying transactions on the blockchain and making sure that the ledger is correct. So you have hundreds of thousands of people making sure that every block is correct. So there you go.
That was well done. Now, I have a number of questions, and since one of these relates to a speaker that we had earlier in the year, we had the CEO of Visa here a while back, and so this question comes up: should the CEOs of Visa and MasterCard be worried about this Bitcoin blockchain thing you're talking about?
Yes, I think not only them, but all the bankers. I mean, you saw, I don't know if any of you read this, but it was big news for us. In the paper, the president of J.P. Morgan said, if any of you, any of my employees, do any trading in Bitcoin, they're fired. He is panicking. He's controlling all of your dollars, right? Your dollars. All these people are moving their dollars into cryptocurrencies, into Bitcoin. And as they move them, they're leaving J.P. Morgan, and they're putting them somewhere else, into a Coinbase account or into a ledger or somewhere else. And he's watching, and he's saying, oh, boy, we're starting to lose our control over these people. He's panicking. If I were Visa and MasterCard, though, there is a problem with Bitcoin right now, and that is once the deal's done, it's done. Visa and MasterCard have both created a credit system. And so they could actually step in there and say, we will provide credit for Bitcoin so that if the transaction needs to be reversed within 4 days, we can manage it. And if they did that, then they got their business for another 40 years.
Well, he had a good talk about how he might be around. So thank you. That's good on that one. Now, what do you see as the future for...
By the way, it takes a long time for a big business to die, you know, when they've been living... Just because it's slow. I mean, you know, how many of you have Bitcoin accounts? Right, 1, 2, 3, 5, 6. That's the very beginning. And it's going to be a big wave. And it's going to change very slowly over time. And as the rest of the... In fact, I believe that in 5 years, you're going to go to the Starbucks, you're going to try to buy coffee with cash, with dollars, and they're going to laugh at you. They're going to say, what, no crypto? What's wrong with you?
Thank you. Now, we now see we've got all these alternatives being announced to Bitcoin. How do we choose among them? How do we determine which has more value and which will be around next week?
Right. Yeah, there are all these ICOs. There are now like something like 2,500 different ICO offerings. I'm lucky because they're all, because I bought the Silk Road money, I see them all. They all come through me because it's like, hey, we need to, you know, we need to do an ICO. You know, we want you on our board or whatever. And so they come through, and here's what I look for. I look for, is there a reason for this to exist? Or are you just raising money for your company? And it has to be a reason that creates a marketplace that wouldn't exist if Bitcoin, can Bitcoin just do it? Or is it a marketplace that's unique or special or has a movement behind it? A lot of these coins have a movement behind them, like a feminist movement or a movement for the health of the planet, or that kind of movement can actually generate a lot of interest, and people will want to exchange that as a currency. But just as Bitcoin came out of the air and is this trusted place where people do their exchange, these other things can get more and more legitimate over time. And so that's, I guess... So I get to meet the people who are starting it and see how many engineers are working on that particular coin, token offering. Coin and token are interchangeable. I get to see them. If I were from the outside looking in and I didn't really get to see that, I guess you could determine, you know, do searches to determine how many engineers are working on each coin, and then you'd kind of figure it out, say, hey, this is really interesting. If you get a bunch of engineers working on something, wait 3 years and something really great will be happening. Elon Musk says, we're going to Mars, and 95% of the people think that guy's crazy. And 5% think, huh, how would we get there? And then the best engineers in the world say, I want to work for that. I want to do that. So you see great entrepreneurs going, I am going to do this. And they're using ICOs to do that, to say, I'm going to make this huge change in the world or the universe or whatever. And that's what's happening with these things. Anyway.
Well, thank you very much. One last general question. We've talked about the fact that Bitcoins are not a national or a fiat currency, they're called. The way the dollar is, so people can go anywhere they want in the world. And the question is, why wouldn't a government in this world want to own the Bitcoin system, and what could they do about it if they wanted to?
Well, that's sort of the beauty of Bitcoin. It is already distributed, and many governments have tried to shut it down, control it, particularly China. Shut it down, control it. They haven't been able to because it's so distributed. If China pushes it down, it's like whack-a-mole. Something pops up. Japan pops up, or Singapore pops up, and then South Korea. South Korea came out against it. South Korea, some of you may even fought in South Korea for freedom. South Korea is supposed to be the free part of Korea, and they are following China's lead and trying to put a kibosh on Bitcoin. I think we got a problem there. We've got, by the way, anybody who has any influence on this, we've got to get back into the Trans-Pacific Pact, that group, because our exit has given China a very strong position, and America really needs to be a part of that. I was traveling all through Southeast Asia and met a very interesting woman. I met that Yun Shan Suu Kyi, who was the prime minister, in effect, the president of Myanmar, and got that Nobel Prize. But it's pretty clear to me that they're all getting very influenced by China now, and China's spreading its wings because the U.S. is pulling out of that TPP. Get back into that thing.
Well, Tim, thank you.
Good, my pleasure.
I need to give you a couple of gifts, which we will send to you. You don't have to
thank
carry
you.
Them. And to tell us about our community. And I thank you so much.
Great. All my right. pleasure.
Thanks. Okay, we're adjourned. Tim. It was terrific.
Great, thank you.
I can tell you, I've studied a lot of this.
Long-term, this is an enormous sea change. And why have a currency that's tied to the political winds of a government if you can have a global one that is completely free?